Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham. Once again, I bring you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, my old buddy, haven't talked to him in a very long time, get a chance to catch up with him today from the podcast TrueAnon, from the band War Crime and Wild Thing. Probably prefers I mention Wild Thing first. Former writer for Max Rock and Roll, coiner of the term Mysterious Guy Hardcore, former freedom fighter, volunteer freedom fighter, former union organizer. This guy has had many lives. Brace Belden is on the show today, and this is a doozy. Get ready for a good one. But first, if you'd like to get in touch with me, head over to the email address turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer, and normally guest booker extraordinaire, but I booked this one all on my own, and he will get the message to me. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do on this show. If you want to get in touch with me directly, I am at Left4Damian on Twitter or Instagram. To support the show, head over to turnedoutapunk.com and pick up a shirt. Thank you to everyone who has done that. We also have a Patreon. Huge thank you to everyone that does check out the Patreon, where I put up footnotes and video versions of some of the episodes and all sorts of fun stuff over there. And, you know, you just support this podcast by telling your friends about it, letting everyone know that you enjoy this podcast, or you can rate it and subscribe to it on iTunes. And thank you to people that do that as well. I also play in a band called Fucked Up. We have postponed our first leg of our David Comes to Life tour. Hopefully we're just going to play it by ear for the dates in February and beyond. The East Coast dates that were supposed to be happening now, if you're listening to this when this comes out, will be moved to July. Find out more information at fuckedup.cc. All right, on to today's show. Today on the show, my buddy Brace, who I have not talked to in a very long time, not spoken to in a very long time. And when I knew him, he was a little kid. I knew him as he kind of grew into sort of this writer, and then played in Wild Thing as well. But like when I first met him, he was just like a little kid. I didn't even know how young he was till we did this interview. And to watch him kind of grow up and live this sort of incredible life, you know, he's living life to the fullest in everything that he does. Just Google this guy and read some of the stories about his time fighting in the People's Protection Units, with the Kurdish army in Syria. Really, he has done a lot of things. We're going to make a movie about his life at one point, starring Jake Gyllenhaal. I didn't ask him about this, so don't worry. I'm not spoiling anything that's coming up in the show. You can read about all this stuff online. We talk about punk, because that's what we do on this show. So I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Check out Brace's podcast. It's a fantastic podcast called TrueAnon that, you know, very cutting political podcast that is a really fun listen. Check out some of Brace's music and Wild Thing. I'm sure he does not want you to check out War Crime. I'm sure you can find their records, but he probably does not want you to find them or listen to them. And that's it. I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Piss Pig Granddad, a.k.a. Brace Belden, on Turned Out a Punk. Brace, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It is a pleasure to be here, Damian.
Well, in addition to being a podcaster, a union organizer, a member of bands, perhaps most germane to this podcast is you are the coiner of the term Mysterious Guy Hardcore. So you have to be here. We had to do this eventually.
You are basically the progenitor of Mysterious Guy Hardcore.
Well, I guess like it all great mysterious hardcore bands, what, you know, you got to put the blanket back on, because once you reveal the truth, not as good as the mystery.
Well, the thing with Mysterious Guy Hardcore was all guys who were like, damn, Fucked Up's got like some crazy ass like lyric, it's like witch lyrics, but what if we played like math rock hardcore behind it, or just metal?
Yeah, it was definitely an amazing time for innovation in hardcore, or lack thereof.
Yes.
Well, Brace, I got to start this off, though, the way they all start off, which is, how did you get into punk? Remember the first time you ever came across it?
I got into punk in Canada.
Whoa.
Yeah. in Vancouver, there is a record store that's like, in my head, it has two stores. There's a movie that has some scene there. That's the only, like, that's what I'm getting my memory of it from.
Was it Zulu Records, maybe?
Zebra or something?
Yeah, I'm trying to think.
It's something with a Z.
Okay. Okay. Maybe Zulu. It must be Zulu then, because I think that's the only one with a Z.
Well, I had been taking bass. I was like 11 or 12, and I'd been taking bass lessons from this guy. And I was trying to learn. Is Nickelback's Canadian, right?
They are.
I was trying to learn. They're on a different story, like that song.
Yes.
And he wouldn't teach it to me. And he gave me, and this sounds fake. I know this sounds fake. He gave me a flipper 10 inch.
That's awesome.
And like some other records, but I have a record player. So my dad was like, oh, you're going to get into punk. And so when I went to this like record store, we were on vacation in Vancouver. He was like, oh, you should look at the Ramones. Then I just bought whatever other CDs looked cool. So I bought Dead Kennedys and the Avengers. So Ramones, Dead Kennedys, Avengers, and Misfits.
So like, what kind of stuff were you into prior to that? Like in addition to the Nickelback?
I was a pudgy metalhead into Dungeons and Dragons.
Same.
So I had long stringy hair. I had my only t-shirt. I had four different AC/DC t-shirts. That's yes. My only shirt and no friends. And so I used to make D&D like games up, and then I would have no one to play them with. So I would just play them by myself. So I was just, and I liked like the radio. I like, you know, I went to Ozfest, saw Hatebreed there, but I didn't like them. And so I was like 11 years old. Yeah. So by the time I was 12, was like fully, like I like heard punk and I was like blown away. I remember walking around the portable CD player in Vancouver and be like, this Ramon shit is crazy.
So where were you kind of hearing music at that point? Primarily the radio, I guess.
Yeah. Live 105, in San Francisco, which was like a alt rock, like, you know, played like Blink 182 and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then KSJO, which was like a classic, like 70s rock to now, I guess, station that I remember. They had Ta Ta Tuesdays, where if you had a KSJO bumper sticker on the back of your car, women were supposed to bare their breasts to you.
The 90s were a wild ass time.
Crazy as hell. Yeah.
It's unbelievable to think about that stuff. It's like a mainstream radio promotion.
They were like, you have to show your tatas to a guy who has the bar. And there'd be people calling in and be like, I just got flashed on the Bay Bridge. Like, it was crazy. You know, it's, and I remember listening to it and be like, whoa, I wonder, like, I didn't really get I didn't see like a naked woman's body even like pictured until I think I was like 12. And so I'd be like, what is that, like, what's, I don't know what's under the shirt, really, like.
That's why you never want to have that bumper sticker on your car, because
never,
kids are going to get the education if they're right beside you.
Exactly. I never saw them.
Where did you kind of you know, go from, like, what was your first concert you went to?
My first concert I ever went to was, well, of my own volition, I think was probably Ozfest. Mm-hmm. But I remember my brother and I saw Blink-182 at the Warfield for his birthday. My dad took us. And I remember there's a guy with a barcode tattoo in the back of his neck. And I was like, even at like 10 or 11, I was like, this is a very silly tattoo. And then Danzig, actually on that, you know what? I must've heard Misfits before, because I saw my family went to Seattle, then Vancouver. And I saw Danzig in Seattle, that trip. So I saw Danzig when I was like 12, and he pointed, he went like this to me.
He knew.
So yeah, like, my dad made fun of me, because he was like, how come you saw this fat guy with a mesh shirt on? I was like, that's not, you wouldn't get it.
Who was the opener?
I actually don't know. I had a tour shirt, but like a long sleeve tour shirt. It's probably worth $1 billion now, but
yeah,
my brother has it. So I don't know. It probably says on the back.
So, like, what was bringing it? Like, where'd you hear the Misfits for the first time? Like, you must have heard them before you got in the punk stuff, because that's like a crazy trip. You got into that and punk at the same time.
Yeah, I think I had like a babysitter or something that liked the Misfits. I remember hearing the Violent Femmes, Nick Cave, and the Misfits from like this lady who used to watch us after school sometimes.
Rocker.
Yeah. So it must have been very, very like kind of like 90s thing to be into. And so I remember my brother was really into like Operation Ivy and like Rancid and stuff. And so I never got into like that kind of like more poppier stuff. I got into like a little older stuff because I didn't want to like the same stuff as my brother. And I was like, this is more like metal.
Like, how prevalent was that stuff in, you know, the Bay Area at that time? Was that kind of like almost like, because, you know, Rancid being a hometown band, mm-hmm. was that almost like mainstream music?
Yeah, it was. They were huge. It was like everyone in school listened to them and stuff.
Yeah.
And then like we'd see them around. I remember Lars Frederick Max from War Crime once called Lars Fredriksson a naughty word when he was getting a photo shoot done. And Lars Fredriksson had one of his boys break Max's skateboard when we were young.
I heard about the same thing happening to Lil Wayne one time.
Really?
Where, yeah, some punk kid started fucking with Lil Wayne, and then his security guards came out and just like knocked the kid out cold. Like,
yeah.
While he was skateboarding, while Lil Wayne was skateboarding.
Incredible.
So what was the like place you kind of went after getting this sort of like starter pack of CDs in Vancouver?
Oh, dog. You know it. The Gilman.
Yeah.
I remember I saw the Attics at Slim's and I had my glass. This was like the first like punk show I went to like with my friends. I saw the Attics in like, I don't know, must have been like 2002 or something. And Mike, I'd never been to like a show with like a mosh pit really, but I guess I've been to like, you know, I'd never like been around it really. And so I was standing up front and immediately song one, glasses get knocked off the face, broken underfoot. And I start like crying a little bit, like, and standing in the back cause I can't see anything.
Yeah.
But then I start going to Gilman and, you know, kind of just Fridays and set, no matter who was playing. And Warm Water Coke, because I remember I begged my dad to buy me a pair of bondage pants from angryyoungandpoor.com. It took me like 3 months to beg him. And he finally bought me a pair of yellow tartan pants with zippers and bondage straps. And I wore them when I was 12 years old. Or like, yeah, I was 12 at that time still. And everyone immediately started just clowning on me mercilessly. And I never wore them again. My dad was so pissed because they were like $60.
Yeah, the Gilman, that does not seem like the place that stuff ever flew.
No. It was. I thought the Casualties were really cool looking, but I don't have the physiognomy. I can't do that.
Yeah. I think you also have to be en masse to pull that off, right?
You got to be with your drunk. Well, we were called. I mean, my little crew of guys at that time, not guys, guys and girls at the time, was called SFDP. This is people like I made friends with kind of like after I got into punk, met at shows, San Francisco drunk punks with an X. Yeah. But none of us looked stupid except for like two guys who could kind of pull off the Mohawk look. Everyone else just looked like idiots.
So who, do you remember the first show you saw at the Gilman? Or some of the early ones that stood out to you?
I can't remember the first. No, honestly, I don't know. One of the first times I ever kissed a girl was the Gilman. And I think the first time I ever really drank was there. But the shows, because I got sent away when I was like 13. And so I missed like a chunk of that. Mm. And so, no, I don't. I actually have no real recollection because that was before I met you and stuff. And so that was like when I got back from all the getting sent away. But no, I remember I saw the Lower Class Brats. Remember that band?
Absolutely. I still got some singles.
Oh, yeah. They're the Addicted to Oi. I remember it was one of their songs. I saw them at the Pound and I saw like bands like the Virus and shit like that. Yeah. That shit was huge back then. But at Gilman's specifically, I can't really remember. I went there all the fucking time.
Was there like, I guess, like, what was the competing venue at that time? Because like, I find when there's always like a opposing venue to the Gilman, it feels like.
There was another one in Marin called, I can't remember what it was called. It was in San Rafael, the Oasis. It was like a few other like startup teen clubs, but none of them, like Gilman was just like consistent and there were less like the for security at Gilman isn't professional. So like you want to go there to hang out. You don't want to go somewhere where there's like a hired security guard that's going to actually make you stop drinking.
Yeah. And also the Gilman has that, like, I know people are always like, oh, there's too many rules of the Gilman, but they've got like that just the perfect amount of rules that it's able to keep going.
Yeah. And at 12, I was like, I don't even know how to break most of these rules.
So you mentioned getting sent away. Like, how long were you gone before you kind of came back?
I got like kidnapped and sent away when I was 13. I was supposed to be gone for like 3 years. I escaped after a year and was on the run for about 5 months. And then, so it was all in all about a year and a half until I was like back normal. Although war crimes started when I was still a runaway. So it was like, that was like a transition. So I was like 14 and a half, probably.
Was it to get you out of punk type thing?
I was just like, I mean, it was funny because it was actually like my like normal kids I knew from school that kind of got me into trouble. One punk kid, but like they had burned down some hill and I took the blame for it. And then I got busted for all this other vandalism that most of it I didn't even actually do. And so I had a probation officer that was like kind of a scumbag. And basically my parents like sent me this like, but it turned out to be a cult in Montana. And they only let you listen to Creedence, Michael Jackson, and the Beatles.
What a weird playlist.
Yeah, it was a fucking wild dude, but not even most Beatles. So I don't like the Beatles to begin with, really. And I like all their contemporaries, but they really used to make us listen to Blackbird Singing in the Dead of Night over and over and over. And the Talking Heads, who I fucking hate.
What a weird playlist of bands.
Yeah, punk was banned. You had to wear like orange t-shirt tucking it, like khaki Carhartts, like, which I guess was like kind of a hipster look now.
Yeah, but not when you're forced to wear it though.
Not when you're forced to wear it. No, and I never could pull out that look. I wanted to.
It felt like also that was like, you know, a wild time for those kind of like boot camps for kids.
Oh yeah.
Like there just felt like that was like, it was, they were advertising them on TV. All those talk shows were basically ads for these things.
Yeah. Dr. Phil, like he was basically, he had deals with all these places, like send your kids in them. I knew so many people who got sent to these because there was all kinds. Like there was like crazy lockdown ones. I went to like a pretty restricted, it was a work farm. I mean, we just worked on a farm and then they did like weird cult stuff with us. Like tried to like brainwash us into having like rebirth ceremonies, but
wow. So did you escape when you were there and make your way back?
No, dude, I was supposed to go back to the Bay Area and like get rid of all my punk stuff because you had to like break down your image. And I was like, fuck that. Like, I love DRI. Like, you'll never take this from me. And so I pretended to go along with it after a failed escape attempt when I first got there. And so I had two or three days back home where I was supposed to get rid of all my stuff, call my friends, tell them that we weren't going to be friends anymore. They hadn't heard from me the entire time I'd been gone, all that stuff. But then I went on to AIM because I was like, my parents won't be able to look up the records. This. I went to AIM and hit up Max. And then he and a couple punk guys came and picked me up. And I stayed in a like a punk house called The Hole for like a while.
I imagine it lived up to the name a little bit.
I lost my virginity there.
Wow.
To a classic punk losing their virginity to a girl with a hairless rat.
Oh my god. Wait, yeah. So when they kidnapped you, did they actually like snatch you off the streets type thing?
No, dude, two guys came into my room at like 5 a.m. And I was like, who the fuck are you guys?
That's so fucking scary.
It was so scary. And then they took me to this like spot in the Oregon Dalles, like the desert. It's like a wilderness program. And then after that, they were like, You're gonna go home. Psych. You're getting sent away for like 2 or 3 years to a farm in Montana.
That's fucking crazy. And that's how they tell you? They don't prep you at all?
They do to some kids, but I don't know, maybe the decision on me was last minute or something.
Yeah,
but yeah, they no prep, not at all.
So when you got back to San Francisco, because you guys kind of like, I remember, I think we had come out there one time before, or maybe not, but like it seemed like when we came out there, war crime was just starting and it was like a whole new scene of kids. Like there was second option. There was like all these new bands kind of happening.
Yeah. Well, there was that like kind of older scene of like, you know, Scotty and Deadfall and like Strung Up and all those bands that were like, to me, those guys were like 100 years old, not 100, but like, I was like, they're all like 40 and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Now,
in retrospect, they were like 21, 22.
But Scotty felt so together even then, like he had like everything figured out.
I interned for Scotty throughout high. Scotty was the reason that I didn't have to go to high school for more than 3 hours a day. I worked for him.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like, I mean, I knew all the like SF drunk punks and stuff before I got sent away. By the time I got back, it was like, there was this whole Bay Area scene with like a million people, like all young kids and like 14-year-old kids. And over like the next year, it started like being way more cohesive. Like War Crime was kind of one of the first like young guy bands. And then all these like other band, like, yeah, Second Opinion, fucking K-Bar, all these other bands started up.
Nightstick Justice, right? Was that?
Yeah. Yeah. That was a little later. That was some of the same guy. Yeah. 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 But like 2-3 years later, Tom.
Yeah. Case of Emergency. And
yes. Well, that guy, Negative Tom, was the first. Do you remember that guy?
Oh, absolutely. Cause I remember meeting him and Tony Molina. They were living together at the time. Classic they had a house, right?
Classic duo. Yeah. South Bay Gods.
South Bay Gods.
When I was a junkie, I almost anonymously sold my record collection to pay back a girlfriend I had stolen a bunch of money from to Negative Tom. He didn't know it was me because I was selling it on Craigslist, and he lowballed me so hard. I respect him, really respect him for that. I'm not even joking. I'm like, that's a record guy for you.
He was that's
like,
how you know this one's true.
Like, I'll give you $1,000. I'm like, what? Oh, man.
So yeah, like you come back and it's like, are you just so you like basically just living the scene at this point, right? Because you're like living at this hole.
Yeah, I mean, I was living at the hole, and there was all these guys there that were like young, like those are like a little. Like I was like 14 at the time, so this was like 17-year-olds that lived there, 18-year-olds. Yeah. But it was all like 18 through like 14 that hung out. And so it was like, yeah, I mean, it was crazy. It was, you know, there was like Warm Water Cove was like having shows all the time. There was like good shows at Gilman. And at this time, all my friends had gotten into like 80s hardcore. Like street punk was done. You know, yeah. Like we were, yeah, like, we, everyone had found out that like, actually, like, I mean, half the bands were just like, I mean, we already all listened like the Adolescents or whatever, but like people were like starting to like dig a little deeper into that. And so I got really, really into 80s hardcore. And I was on the run for like four or five months. And then I went back to my parents' house. And at that point they were like, just do whatever, you know, yeah, like go crazy. And so War Crime was like, we started because we wanted to be like Suicidal Tendencies, not musically, but we're like, we want to be the dumbest band and get a fan base that we have to disavow. Because that'll get us attention and we don't have to learn how to play that good, which worked. And so we like, yeah, we were like one of the sort of like, I wouldn't say like it congealed around us, but it was like us. I think we were really among the first of like the younger bands to start. I think Second Opinion was around before us. There's a couple other ones. But like by the time we started, not because of us, but just around the same time that we started, all these new like younger guy bands were starting up.
Yeah, I think you're also probably the first one to really tour too.
Yeah. We were with... You know what? I just realized where I met Jonah was in San Jose when I was like 14 or 15, when the Career Suicide played, I think with the Rotten Fucks or maybe with some other bands.
Okay.
And that was like, there was all these San Jose guys in the scene too, that were like a little older and like they'd smoke crack and shit. And like, so we thought they were like, and they actually had Mohawks and looked cool with them. Yeah. And so, I mean, at that time it was fucking crazy. Like the Bay Area had a huge scene. Like, yeah, bigger than any like I've really seen since, like just all across the Bay in every different town. There was this different sort of scene, a different sound, and all like kind of came together. So these pretty big shows.
Yeah. Like it feels like it's kind of consistent that, you know, the Bay Area is going to have one of the bigger scenes because there's just, yeah, so many different types of punk happening, but it just felt like everything was kind of going in the same direction at that time. Like everyone was, yeah, like, yo, 80s hardcore, being in a cool bands that sound good. And we're all like, okay, this is good. It's not like, yeah, there's an emo thing. There's like a other thing happening at the same time.
Well, and we were also lucky to have Burnt Ramen.
Yeah.
Which was like a little, I don't know what I call a warehouse, just like a venue in Richmond. That was like an illegal venue that you could have shows at. And the combination of that and having guys like Scotty around to like really nurture a scene and like actually kind of like, not manage it, but like people who kind of like kept it cohesive was, mm-hmm, really, really fucking like, that was crucial.
Yeah. He was almost like a babysitter at a time. Like I remember coming back and it was all like, not babysitter, but in the sense that he was like, you know, once again, as you said, like only like 6 years older, 7 years older than everyone, yes, else around him, but like still like the oldest person in the room, like, yeah, booking the venue and like, you know, making sure yes. that the show happens and stuff.
Yeah. I remember he kicked us out. We went to go hang out at the Deadfall House one time, like when I was like 16 and me and some guys, and he kicked us out because they were going to do coke. And he was like, you guys can't be around for this. And I was like, what? Like, those guys think they can book our bands, but they won't even let us. I'd never done coke before. It was just like, so offended.
When also like War Crime came out and kind of did the best play you can do in music, which is piss everyone off.
Everyone. I mean, War Crime is something that I never thought this would have happened. Although I guess I should have maybe predicted it, but War Crime continues to haunt me to this day. And let this be a warning for all young listeners out there. You think that you're like 14 and have a really good idea to make everyone mad because it gets you attention. If you have attention, people go to the shows. No, my friend. The best you can say about us, we really were punks because we were rotten little guys. But yeah, we decided we wanted to make we at one point were hanging up the flag of Israel and an SS flag at all of our shows. I don't even know what that. Like,
God.
We were just like, this covers every base that we can have, because we realized that if anyone came on stage to try to fight us and all our friends would just beat the shit out of them.
Yeah.
And so, because we fought a lot at shows, and so we were like, well, we're good up until, of course, the infamous trash talk incident. But the. Like it was like we kind of just weren't taking it really seriously, and we're like, we're punk, we're like Sid Vicious, and we'll just like be stupid and like silly bad, not knowing that people would take it really seriously eventually.
Well, and then it's also, that's just like the thing with punk too, especially at that time, is like all the modeling is like, no, this is the play, like look yeah. at all the bands, all the great bands did crazy offensive shit,
yeah,
and that's what made them stand out.
I remember we played a show at Burnt Ramen and I wore a dress with a swastika on. I mean, I'm the most visibly Jewish human being in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, I look like a fucking Der Stürmer drawing. And so I was like, we can get away. We did get away with it, but people were like, there was like a core group of people that were like, fuck these kids. And like, I remember hating them at the time and now being like, well, I get it, you know?
Well, it's so interesting too about the scenes that pop up in the Bay too, because it always feels like there's like obviously like a really powerful organized political leaning punk scene, mm-hmm. and then there's always like against a foil to that, you know, like yeah. you look back at the Fuck Ups, you know, and there's always just sort of like consistently a history of this thing.
Dude, when we found out about the Fuck Ups, I was like 15 or 16. I was like, this is like what we're doing.
Yeah,
like this
yeah.
is like, because I had known about the Vats and stuff and like MDC. I remember Dave Dichter from MDC wrote my middle school letter because I got suspended from middle school for wearing like that Klan cop shirt,
yeah.
you know, like
yeah.
the MDC logo. And he sent a letter to my principal being like, it's about killing the cop inside your head. I'm like, dog, no, it's fully definitely not. Your band's called Millions of Dead Cops. But I all these bands we looked up to were like, we didn't really, I mean, the thing is, the Bay Area, we were like, well, everyone's like a liberal here. And so like this, what will make these people mad? You know, like we can't like, I don't know, like war sucks, but like, you know, what really rules is like making your parents mad at you.
Yeah.
Which is part of, I mean, it's part of the weird paradoxes, but like, I guess kind of paradox of being a punk, like after the initial wave is you got to kind of keep inventing new ways to piss people off.
Well, even the initial wave too, right? Like even you go yeah. back to the proto-punk stuff, they were playing with that stuff to piss people off and to,
oh, for sure.
It feels like that's always punk thing is part of it is playing with stuff that you don't fully understand.
Yeah.
Or for effect. And then realizing later in life, oh shit, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say no one got hurt, because definitely a lot of people got seriously injured during this time period. But like, we were just doing literally whatever audience we had, we would do whatever we could to make them mad.
Mm-hmm.
And like that. So it changed every show. I remember our first show was at Concord High and our friend Straight Edge Mike beat up a teacher. I remember We played at the store. Like, yeah, like kind of bad actually.
Did he go to the school?
Yeah, we played the talent show.
So he knew he was going to have to see this teacher again.
No. Straight Edge Mike didn't. Our drummer, Straight Edge Sean, we called him Adolf Edge, which he was so mad about because he was the only one who was like really into politics. And so he's like wearing like a Derudy t-shirt. We're like, yeah, we made him draw X's on his hands, even though he was like, I'm just Straight Edge. Like, I don't want to. We made him wear hockey jerseys. He ruled. But we played our first show at Gilman. I remember we insisted on playing the store. Scotty has a live tape of that. It was the most fun show I've ever played before. There was no show before that, but after, I mean, it was the greatest show of my career.
Did bands ever play the store, or were you guys the first to do it?
No, there were bands had played it before, okay. But I don't think they had many after us because it was like a disaster. The playing the store, that's the move though. If you play Gilman, is play the store in Gilman.
Oh, it's tiny.
Oh, it's very tiny. Yeah.
Where are they putting the amps? Like up on that like back counter?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, wow.
And I stood at the back counter and sang. I mean, it's like a house show.
Well, how long is this period before the period where you're touring and you're putting out records on No Way?
So probably for about a year and a half.
Okay.
I think we put out a demo tape. I feel like I met Brandon. I went on tour with Annihilation Time when I was like 15 and Municipal Waste, which was illuminating. But I feel like I met either Brandon on that tour or shortly after. I think I met him through Annihilation Time, and we'd given him our demo tape, and maybe we eventually played with the Rec Control in the Bay, and he hit us up to put out a record. So I must've been like 16, like a sophomore or whatever, the junior in high school. And or what's the third year?
We don't have that system in Canada.
I can't remember. I only went to like 2.5 years of high school. So
junior, senior. No, I think I don't know. Yeah, sophomore.
No, sophomore second. No, it's junior year.
Okay. Okay.
But so I remember he hit us up to put out a record, and I was like, what? So like a year and a half, year after we started, I flipped out because I was like, this guy's gonna put out like our record on a record. Like, I couldn't believe it. And he sent us all these, like, because you know Brandon could draw real good. He sent us all these like logos he had drawn up and stuff. And after that, we recorded with Jeff Leppard, RIP actually, at Lennon Studios, and put out this 7-inch that was just, again, the only record I've ever done that's on Spotify is this record.
It's actually amazing because that he was kind of doing the Sub Pop of hardcore at that point.
Yeah.
Like that was the label to get onto. If you're doing like, you know, traditional straight up hardcore, like that was the place. Like, and you know, like, and it really did, like, I guess thrust you guys onto like, you know, I guess it's weird because in the Bay, you're already on the national scene in terms of punk because it's like the media center of punk rock.
Yeah.
But like, I guess that put you on like the wider sort of scene.
Yeah. Like we could actually like, I remember we went on tour. We did a 2.5 month tour with this band Rabies.
Oh my God.
Dude, the worst. I think I was 16, I believe, or 16 or 17 when we did this. The most fucked up idea in human history was to do this fucking tour. And we were sharing like a drummer and a guitarist. I feel like it was like some fucked up shit like that. And during the summer, and I had never really been outside the Bay in the summer, and the Bay gets to like 75 tops in the summer. And so I was like, oh, it's hot everywhere. And I was fat and I had kind of like longish hair. And like, I had to wear like shorts, which I still don't love. And so it was like this, like, every picture from that, and I still wore fingerless gloves. It was like, we went on this fucked up, awful tour we played in Canada, I think with Terminal State in Toronto. That makes
sense. Yeah. I think I remember that show happened actually.
Yeah. It's some like basement place. I feel like,
I'm trying to think where that show would have been because I think by that point, word had already spread about you guys coming to town. Like, oh, this is War Crime. This is the band that everyone's talking about. But I think we were on tour when it happened.
I think you were, because I remember I wanted, like, because I knew Jonah like decently, because we'd played with Career Suicide.
We went on tour with them, right? Like a short 5-day or 3-day tour or something, he said.
Oh, Yeah, dude, 2 years ago.
Oh, no, I think this is before that. Back in the day, he said.
Probably did. I honestly don't remember.
But then 2 years ago, too?
Dude, we did a reunion tour with Career Suicide 2 years ago.
How did I not know about that? That's amazing.
Damien, you have never known humiliation until you're singing, I don't want to go to high school at 30 years old at the Dollhouse in Pomona at 4 p.m. on a Sunday because you have to leave by 6 because Bonebreaker's playing at night and they're Nazis. You're not allowed to hang out there anymore.
I heard about that show. I heard about that disaster of a show, actually. That's wild.
Well, I first saw you guys at Warm Water Cove.
That show, yeah, like we're at the really tiny PA cord.
Yes.
And I would carry the PA around.
I feel like, yeah, yes, you did.
Yeah, I remember that's such a fun show.
I remember also being like, these guys are like 40 years old. These guys
were
like,
old.
It's like Van Halen or something. Like,
well, you're like 10.
Yeah, I was a child back then.
And it's so weird. Like, I talk about this all the time on the show and people make fun of me for it now. But like being a parent and having kids at the age where, you know, you would start to get into punk, it just feels like, and I'm not just saying for my kids, like all the kids around them, like none of these kids feel like they're at that, you know, I'm fed up with my parents, I'm going to go find something level yet.
Well, I'm so glad I did find punk when I did, because I was such a fucking I just read fantasy novels and like old science fiction books and like was kind of like a shut in. And I love people, but I didn't know how to like, I didn't like the people in my school. And growing up in a punk, despite all of the bad shit I just talked about, was like the, I think the healthiest possible outcome that could have happened to me.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Like, it's like, where else are you introduced to these kinds of ideas, you know, or like what other, like if you ran away from home, where else would have a squat scene that you could kind of stay in?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Like where else would I, like, I even talking to people now, they'd be like, how do you know people in like Columbus, Ohio? I'm like,
yeah.
What are you talking about? Kevin is a Pink Reason, you know, fucking those first 2 7 is just some of the greatest records ever made in the mid 2000s.
What scene was that again? Was that shit?
That was Shitfi. Yeah. That was like, he was actually one of the only bands I liked from that scene. But
We went on tour with Psychedelic Horseshit and they were the funniest, coolest band ever. Like the funniest guys.
I loved those guys. Did not like listening to that. I remember I saw Psychedelic Horseshit and I was like, damn, this is challenging.
Yeah. No, they, every night we went out with them, it was the best band to have on tour with you, 'cause you knew that they were going to get booed.
Oh,
like, and they were just going to like eat it up. Like, it wasn't like they were going to get pissy about it. The crowd's like, fuck you, you guys suck. And they're like, yep. Yeah, whatever. Yep.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's like that whole scene, like Clock Cleaner.
Yeah.
Like the most infuriating live band I've ever seen. 'Cause they had this fucking strobe light and I was trying to see them at Hemlock and I snuck in. I wore a disguise to go to the show. I put on literally a disguise and used Noel from Annihilation Times ID. And and I saw Clock Cleaner and I was like, this is the worst band I've ever seen in my life. To this day, the worst band I've ever seen. Love Sharky. Love Puerto Rico Flowers too. That fucking Burning Down Your House, that song, incredible.
Yeah, but and Deep Clock Blues were great too.
I haven't heard them, but I assume I love Sharky.
Yeah.
But yeah, terrible. So, well, anyways, we went on this fucking 2.5 month tour. Then Brandon wants to put out an LP. That, and we put out a fucking LP, which to this day it blows my mind that we did that. Not, it's a pretty okay LP. It's like we try to get a little too fancy with the recording.
Do you think, like, frankly, looking back on it, because you're playing a character, right? Like you had a name for this whole thing. Was it an extension of this sort of fantasy role playing thing a little bit?
Kind of, yeah. It's like I mean I thought it was like, because I know punk was silly. Punk is silly. That's kind of what I like about it. And it was like, well, I can kind of play I was never a big wrestling guy, but I know what a heel is. And it's like playing the heel on stage, spitting on the crowd, you know, chain out. I remember I spit in a guy. When we played in Montreal, we were playing the show and there was, I think, what's one of the crust bands in Montreal?
Inepsy?
It wasn't Inepsy because I'd be too starstruck.
CCSS?
I can't, it might have been it was a guy in a band that I knew about.
Okay.
I was like, he had like a pitcher or he had like a mug of beer on our show. And I was like, come here, like asking if I could have a sip. And he like kind of held it up to me and I spit in it. And we ended up getting like this big fight, like on stage. The guy like punches me so hard that
is
I
that
think
the gates
I almost,
of hell too that you're playing at, probably.
I can't, I mean, dude, 2000, I was like, also like, I'm 17 and like no one's carding me here. Like I'm getting fucked up. I was just like, I'm going to be this little dirt dog, you know, like this little rotten little man on stage. Cause you know, I'm like a nebbish little guy. And so it's fun to be, lead singer, you got to know what I'm talking about here. You never know what to do with yourself on stage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, unless you're Iggy.
I don't think he knows either, right? Like, that's why he's cutting himself up with bottles, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's like out of nerves. Like, all the things I did to fuck myself up on stage, like, if I was a well adjusted, confident performer, I would have found a way to perform without doing that stuff to myself.
I feel like I saw you once and you did the razor
blade
head
job.
Thing.
Yeah.
Blade
I used job, to do it a lot. Yeah. And it's something that was even, it's funny, I was talking to Martin about this last night. Like, hitting yourself in the face with a microphone, that hurts a lot.
That hurts
right?
a lot, dude. And I've done it a lot.
Yeah. And you bleed so little. For the amount of damage you do. And then, so that's the performative side of it. As soon as I realized like, oh shit, I can just pull a knife out or like a little tiny razor blade and bleed buckets and don't have to bash my head in to do it. I was like, oh, this is performance.
Yeah. 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 I was still too pussy to do that, but I was like, I'll hurt other people. And so I'd swing a chain around. I never knew what to do. Cause I'm not very limber.
Yeah. Well, and also the thing is that, and this is a weird thing with punk rock too, is this sort of like Peter Pan Neverland world where you guys are little kids interacting with adults in a world where adults are kind of like, well, these are the standards you have to live up to and perform to.
Yes.
And you're like a bunch of little kids. You're like, well, fuck you. I'm a kid.
Yeah. 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 I was like, well, it was also just like, we're going to do, I hated so much of the 90s kind of runoff stuff. Like, I mean, everything from like Nausea to the Gravity stuff. Like, I just like did not like anything from the 90s. I've softened obviously since, but, I was like, I associated that so much with like this kind of like granola hippie kind of punk, all of it, even no matter what kind of punk it was. And so I was like, well, this is like, we're going back to the roots of like, you know, and being nasty. And honestly, it got us attention and it worked. And so I kept like I continued with it. I mean, so much of it was just me aping old Target videos that we had bootlegs of and being like, okay, well, Sick Pleasure Guy does this during their set. That Sick Pleasure Target set is incredible.
Incredible. Unbelievable. Incredible. That band, just, lyrics aside, one of the best bands of all time.
Oh my, they changed my, that was like, I think I had an AIM screen name of like Sick Pleasure for like a week before. I was like, this sounds like a sex thing. Divorced of context.
A little kid on AIM with the name Sick Pleasure.
Exactly. Like a 15-year-old kid being like, hey guys. Like I was like, this is like, you know, it was like us who didn't know a lot. I mean, I read American Hardcore probably 10,000 times. I read like the Germs book. I read all that stuff like a million times. And it was just me trying to do like my best approximation of that stuff. But I wasn't like, but it was like, it's weird because it's like a photocopy of a photocopy. And so it just came out in this like kind of warped way.
But it's funny how that's like, it's like the Tekashi 6ix9ine model for like building yourself as an artist is like you make a huge splash and then, you know, people are going to be like, fuck this band. But then there's also going to be a lot of people that are just like, well, what's this thing and drawn to it too. And it just feels like, you know, punk is something that until recently, I think it's all changed obviously now, but like,
yeah.
That was almost encouraged by like what you're saying. When you read the history books, when you read about the Germs and you're like, oh, they got on the scene because everyone thought they were terrible. You know,
yeah.
And they were like the band because they're like, oh, they're so bad. Even though they're the best band ever. But like,
yeah,
it's you're almost encouraged to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. And like late, you know, my band after like when I was like 19 or whatever, it was like more normal in terms of like
Wild Thing.
What we did. Yeah. Yeah. Like in terms of like playing and like, you know, not being shocking for the sake of being shocking, although we definitely did a lot of that too, was like it is a lot easier to get attention if you're just like a fucking crazy ass kid who's like, you know, lashing out everywhere, because then everyone's like, oh, look at this, you know, sort of nightmarish of child.
Yeah.
Because everyone loves watching like a nightmare child, you know, thrash around on stage.
Yeah. Yeah. And everyone likes watching a train wreck. You know,
yeah.
Like that's,
yeah. That's... But it's funny because I was like a fake train wreck. I mean, we were doing like a lot of bad shit, but like, I wasn't like, I didn't do coke probably until I was like 17. You know, I didn't like, I was.
Oh no, I don't mean like a train wreck in like a human terms, but I mean like just in terms of being a band, like a band that's like a self-destruct mission on stage.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
When did you start writing for MRR?
Oh, brother. I think it was at a sex vid show. I believe actually at War Crimes Lash. In my head, this might not be true. This might be just two shows that happened in a similar time frame. But I think I booked Sex Vid, Mysterious Guy Hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
Who's actually like, that was like the distillation of Mysterious Guy Hardcore after like you guys sort of like spread the seed. That was like the first flower to, I'm not saying that they're, you know, I'm not saying they ripped you guys off or anything, but you know what I mean? It was
no,
like,
yeah, that, absolutely. And
in my head, that's a linear kind of thing.
Well, and it's funny because like I got Mike from Fucked Up's tape collection, and I guess they're not here. I moved them across the room, but there's like the tapes that him and Judd would, before Sex had started, when Fucked Up was just starting, that him and Judd would trade with each other, where they're like basically learning about being mysterious guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. He's working. I someone just told me they saw him in Austin recently.
Yeah. No, he's at End of an Ear. And
yeah.
And yeah, he's awesome. Like I saw him, God, well, it's pre-pandemic, so 2 years ago now, but he was, yeah, it's so great. Like still crazy record collector, you know, like those, that whole band like was just like the most intense record collector nerd vibe band ever.
I remember Judd was kind of mean to me, and I thought that was cool. I was like, yeah, that's respect.
Well, that's what you're saying about Clock Cleaner, psychedelic horse shit, even like it's almost like that period of punk. It's so different than now, where it's almost like it's almost like you want to serve your audience as much as you can.
Yeah.
Whereas back then you wanted to piss the people off. So
much.
Like, fuck you for coming to see my band.
Yes, absolutely. Well, and so I booked the show. I think it was at the Sex Vid show, because Layla was there, who was Sex Vid's number one fan in America.
Yes.
And I remember Layla like asking me in the back. It was like in some warehouse. And she was like, oh, like, you know, you're make everyone mad. Like, do you want to write for MRR? And I was like, absolutely. And I had like obviously publicly hated on MRR, because that was like, I had this zine. No, you know what it was? I had a zine called Mean Punk, which if there are any extant copies out there, it's a legendary zine. I'm not going to blow myself up here, but it's the stuff of legends, because it was so stupid and insane that people, literally a guy asked me about it like a week ago. He's like, oh, I was looking through my like zine the other day. It's the most like deranged zine ever made. I made one issue, Mean Punk number one. And on the basis of that, Layla asked me to start writing a column, which I called The Last Punk. And, my God, I'm so surprised that no one's like dug up the archives of that to like cancel me with.
Go on. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say it's MRR, right? So they weren't probably letting you say anything that crazy.
I said insane shit in there, because they knew, because even MRR knows that if you're insane, people will read it.
Yeah.
And, so I said all kinds of weird shit in there. Who knows? I mean, I was on a lot of drugs by this point, but I would spend 30 days or 28 days of the month being like, I should write my column. And 3 days before we had to go to print or whatever, I would write it in, like, I would take a bunch of drugs and then write it in one night and get out there. And even the name, The Last Punk, made people so mad at me. At one point I made up an interview. I tried to get Mike Sniper from the Blank Dobs for an interview.
Yes.
He puts a kibosh on that. I'm like, all right, well, I just made up an interview with him where I said that he got the name Blank Dogs from his nanny, who was told him about this white ghost dog that she used to see. And she called it Blanco Dog, because she was half like Spanish.
I remember when that thing, because that was also when Blank Dog, you weren't supposed to know that it was Mike Sniper at that point, right? Like it was like still meant to be a secret. And I remember that, reading that in that column, being like, yo, this dude is on one. This is so nuts.
Mike later shoulder checked me at the knockout, which I'm sure he would dispute this day to this day, but he's a sweet guy. It's,
yeah. I
mean, this beef is a million years ago. So it was just shit like that. Like just me doing insane shit. I loved hanging out of the MRR house. They gave me a key. Although I did get kicked out of there at one point because me and, I'm sure they won't mind me saying this, and Total Control, not Mikey, but it was like DX. It must've been Total Control and some of the UV race guys. We all took acid and we went there at one point during that night. And, I'm not going to say who, but somebody from the cohort found a screwdriver record they had in there, slapped that motherfucker on the turntable, and they kicked us out. And we're like, is your screwdriver record? We didn't bring this. What are you guys doing with it here?
It's got, well, that's still like the ultimate repository of everything in punk. Except there's, well, he sold some of the records, right? Like Tim went through before he passed away and got rid of like a chunk of stuff that he just didn't think was good.
Mm-hmm. Fucked up Chemistry of Common Life.
No, that was a big heartbreaker for me.
That's what it saved the business though. Yeah. He did at some point get rid of a lot of stuff, but they also, and then of course there was an issue with the former coordinator who had maybe taken some records.
Yeah. And then stuff went disappeared after too. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember there was, a band from Toronto that was told like, yeah, you guys can't stay here. Cause when you stayed here, records went missing shortly thereafter.
I heard about that. In fact, I knew it was a band from Toronto, but yeah I heard about that. And yeah, people would steal. I mean, it was, dude, if you wanted to steal something from there, only thing that would stop you is punk's honor.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, and punks don't have a lot of honor, unfortunately, when it comes to records.
No, I mean, I've stolen one record in my entire life, which is the Cleanse the Bacteria test press.
Whoa.
Yeah. No cover though.
Well, I don't think it had a cover, right?
I don't think so either.
Yeah, it's a test press, right?
Yeah, test press. Signed by and numbered by Pusshead.
Holy shit.
Yeah, I stole it from a record store that I worked at for 1 week when I was like 15, and the guy just didn't pay me. And then he later overdosed at his 14-year-old girlfriend's apartment and died, or her parents' apartment. And so they like put everything on sale at his record store. And I found that, and I put it into a Journey record and bought the Journey record for $1.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That is the darkest record finding story I think I've ever heard. 14 year old girlfriend.
The guy was a straight up pedophile. When I worked there, I was like 15. I was like 14, 15, 16 around that era. He like straight up closed the store to have sex with like a prostitute. And he was like, you got to go get some lunch or something.
Holy. Well, that's the thing about record stores. Like we live in a post vinyl resurgence universe. Now pre vinyl resurgence, record stores were like scumbag kind of environment sometimes.
Oh, absolutely.
A lot of times.
Yes. And it, and like the record dude, before it got like cool to like records, the record dude was like, he made the vile toy model train collector look like a knight in shiny armor.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it was kind of like those guys knew, you know, like we're geeky. The record store guy thought he was kind of a rock star, but was just also geeky and also super skeevy. Like how many record stores also sold used pornography in Toronto? Like I can think of at least five.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. 100%. I mean, it's just like a lot of guys trying to rip you off too. Like selling records to those places was always a nightmare.
Yeah.
You know,
get out the price guide, the gold mine price guide, like trying to the, I don't see anything about infest in here.
Yes. The best one in San Francisco was one called Grooves, where I hung out every day after school, basically. This guy, Kelly Stoltz, who actually is a musician who I really
like. Oh, yeah.
He worked there and he would just like, cause when I was like 16, 17, I was like, oh, there's music besides punk. And he would like turn me on to all this kind of like crazy ass shit that he dug. And so that really, I credit that experience with like opening my mind up to a lot of stuff.
So where'd you, you know, like you mentioned getting into drugs, like where did that kind of, I guess it comes to a head at a certain point, right? Is that before or after you go, it must be before you go overseas.
Yeah, I was, you know, when I was like into hardcore punk, like some people do coke sometimes. My mom was like kind of into that stuff. So I died. And so I was like, you know, I don't ever want to touch drugs. But then, of course, one day I'm walking to a party at R&L's Pizza, which is like wherever an Annihilation Time worked. And someone was like, do you want to do a bump? And I was like, you know what? That sounds fantastic. I hated Coke. Mm. And I barely ever, I mean, I did it, you know, but I didn't do it that much. Actually, that's not true. I did it a lot, but I didn't buy it that much. But this is like really kind of when like Oxycontin was hitting a peak, and I moved into this like apartment with these kind of garage rocky people. And one of them was really addicted to Oxy. And so he started hooking me up with it. And then later I started playing in a band with a guy who was addicted to heroin, and he was a taxi cab driver. And we'd drive around this like drug dealer, this heroin dealer, and I would get heroin from that and then kind of progress in that. But that was more when I was like 19, 20, 21, 22, that kind of era.
The Coke thing came back in huge in punk. Like I remember first getting into punk, yeah. You never saw it, right? And then it was like, then it hit and in the mid 2000s and it was everywhere.
Everywhere. And it's crazy now because now it's ketamine.
Yeah.
Which.
Or what's the, I met in LA, the kids, nitrous.
Dude. You saw that like those like pandemic like outdoor shows.
Yeah. Yeah.
I went to those and like, dude, full on nitrous tanks at the shows. That is advanced, dude. We like, that would have been unthinkable to us.
I did this like thing that never came out, like a podcast documentary talking to like younger kids at DIY shows. And I was in LA and I was talking to these kids and I'm like, what's the biggest problem facing, you know, your scene right now? And they're like, the NOS guy, the nitrous guy showing up at the shows with his gang to protect him, because every time he shows up you never know what's going to happen.
I mean, let's look at fucking Phish concerts. Whippet Mafia,
same
kind of shit. I mean, nitrous is, there's money in the tank.
It's so, I went to a show and I hadn't been to, like, you know, I'm a dad now, so I don't get to many, you know, real street level punk shows as much as I'd like to. And I was there and this dude full up, like set up a distro style thing with whippets. It was crazy. Dude,
there were competing Nazca at those outdoor shows. There was like competing. Someone shooting a gun in the air. I'm like, damn. Cause we used to play like backyard, like East LA, like, cause in LA to me, there's always been kind of two punk scenes. There was when I was younger, there was like a big, like scene of guys who were sort of like post Stitches types guys. You remember that band, the Stitches?
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Like guys who would be embarrassed to be like, we used to like the Stitches, but clearly were very influenced by having been guys who liked the Stitches. It was white guys. And then there was like East LA, like Mexican, big crust scene at the time. Although it seems more like D beat kind of now. And those shows, I remember we played, I think we played with Government Warning, a couple shows like that. And I was like, damn, this is fucking crazy. Like, this is like, just half the people at this show aren't even punks. They're just like fighting people.
Well, those outdoor shows, that Section 8 footage, that to me, like, looked like what parents warned you about with punk. Like, you don't want to go to those punk shows. They're crazy. And then you're like, you get to a punk show and it's just like, you know, like three dudes skanking around and then someone's got a distro in the back.
Yeah, there's like a ska guy, and you're like, I guess my parents were right. This sucks. No, but dude, I went to the second one of those like Section 8 shows, and the fucking, we couldn't even get in because it was like already like surrounded by cops, everything shut down. And there is fucking like kind of like they're shutting down the show, and there's like runoff, like people like leaving in thousands of people. And there's this like drunk punk dude, and like these two drunk punk guys, and event basically. I see a fight between two guys with full-size, legit, no-shit whips. A whip
fight. Like a bullwhip?
Like a bullwhip. Like 6 months ago. And I'm like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen in my goddamn life.
That is awesome. Yeah. That is like, I don't even, like Indiana Jones. That's like the ultimate Indiana Jones fantasy.
Only one real like straight up whip hit was I clocked, but they before they started like just like have all their friends, like everyone just got into a big brawl, and in the melee that ensued, a third party stole both whips and like absconded with them, and like and the guy whose whips they were was like so pissed. He's like, "Those are $50 whips!" Like, it was so fucking tight.
Punk is never gonna suck. It's going to go on forever and still going to be awesome somehow.
There are very few ways for young people to be publicly annoying in that particular way. You know what I mean? in like a kind of like silly sort of way. Mm-hmm. And it's yeah, there's always going to be punks.
Yeah. No, it feels like, you know, like every step when someone's like, well, that's it, that there's nothing else. And then there'll be another group of kids that will offend people or do things completely differently and just build up a new scene. Like, that's the best part about this whole thing.
I mean, what blows my mind is in the Bay Area right now, like there, it's like, it's changed so much, obviously, in the ways that everyone knows about, got, you know, gentrified and stuff. But what really blows my mind is like, there isn't like after kind of our generation, like a generation slightly younger than us, like there wasn't really like a big youth, like movement scene mm-hmm. to replace punk. It sounds like that happened other places. LA, it seems like that really happened, but like Bay Area, it's really stopped being like one of the epicenters of punk.
I've kind of realized you almost need like 2 or 3 years before like a huge band to blow up and get mainstream popular. And then it's like the kids are kind of in the wake, right? Like I'm the kids post Nirvana, and there are the kids post Green Day, and mm-hmm. then the kids post Blink-182. And you don't really have that band kind of after Blink-182, but I guess in LA you do have like local phenomenas, and LA stuff got so big just locally. It's kind of like a different beast.
For sure. And like, just, I don't know what it is, but like LA I used to hate playing down here and coming down here, but like, it's tight now. Like there's like shows all the fucking time, you know, it's like all different kinds of punk. It's cool.
It's funny, 'cause like, I remember going there and playing the first few times, and it was still like a super divided scene. There was like, the East LA stuff. And then there was almost like the more like hardcore Revelation Records type world. And then there's also like sort of that emerging hipster kind of thing that's also kind of happening at the same time. And then it feels like post Trash Talk, like they unified so much of those things, you know,
yeah.
And like their shows were like all different types of kids coming.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like there's a lot more. I mean, when I was growing up, all our friends were like, it was like us punks, but all the other young kids we hung out with were graffiti guys.
Mm-hmm.
And like who like were go to punk shows, but like weren't into punk or anything, like into hip hop or like whatever else. And it seems like that was kind of like that like that's like a really big key to like making shows big too, because it's just like not just have young people that only like punk, but just like young people who like to have a good time. And so like LA seems to have that in kind of in spades too.
Yeah. Yeah. LA is like something also where you just put out something on the street and just people will appear out of like the woodwork and the sewers, like just like, like weird, like where's this guy come from?
Well, I do want to clear something up. Speaking of Trash Talk, the Tony Molina on your show.
Yes.
He mentioned a tussle that happened between our drummer and members of Trash Talk based on a misunderstood basically series of words.
Yes.
I remember this. Because I wasn't like, I was just like outside drinking or something. And so it sort of like came in towards the middle of this. Our drummer was like, and he still is, he's like the sweetest, like nerd, like beyond even record nerd, like a genuine nerd. And he had said something about like, oh, look at these muscle men. And I guess one of the guys from Trash Talk thought he said muscle men, like how British people used to call Muslims in like the 1800s.
Yeah.
Or like said, look at these Muslims or something. And it became like this big fight. And I think me and Lee were the only people who didn't actually fight in it. Although I just know I didn't, because I was just like, oh, I'm not getting my ass kicked. Like if he said that or if he didn't say that, you know. But I later talked to him and he was so confused by what happened, because he's like, I just said that he had big muscles. And I later found out what had actually happened, and I could not believe it. Most insane thing. But I believe the beef, I don't think I've talked to Lee since that happened, but I believe the beef has been squashed, which that beef is old enough now to actually be at Gilman.
Yeah. Yeah. That beef is going to shows now. That beef started a band.
Yes.
And it's completely new sounding. No, I remember, because we were playing, that was during our set. Cause they,
that was your
on.
Show.
Yeah. Yeah. What happened was we were in that vegetable oil powered school bus.
Oh my God, dude. Yes. The school bus.
The school bus. And it took us, because it broke down a million times. So it took us forever to get to the show. So Trash Talk played super early, and we got there and Lee's like, can we jump on? Because we had to play like really early. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. So they jump on. I had to go to the bathroom. I run to the bathroom, come back, and it was just like the vibe was so good. And then after I got back, the vibe was so harsh. And I'm like, what happened? And people are like, oh, it was a crazy fight. And someone told me you, it was between you and I guess Garrett was who it was with at the time.
Are you kidding me? Garrett would have killed me.
Well, that's what I heard. The kid got fucking destroyed. And that I was like, for years I thought that, and then Tony set me straight. So I owe you an apology. I did not propagate that rumor, but I did think that in my head.
Oh, I've heard this has gotten brought up to me by so many people over the years. Cause it's funny. Cause after for a while, I was like, I don't know. It wasn't that big a deal. We fight at shows all the time, but that the legend of that story grew, too. But like trash talk, any one of those guys could have kicked all of our asses. And so I was like, there's no way. When I hear people like, you guys all fought them, like, what are you talking? All fought them?
I would say that every single time we played the Gilman, not every single time, most of the time there was some sort of crazy fight that would ensue.
I mean, I probably saw you guys every time you played at Gilman.
There was one time where it was like a huge thing outside afterwards.
Always. Yeah.
Like with Lights Out played, and there was some crazy shit that went down afterwards.
That was Casey's band, right?
No, it was... why am I blanking?
No, Kevin. 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 Shit. Yeah. Oh, I just talked to his wife the other day. Great guy. The Gilman was the site of a lot of my getting my ass kicked, and one of the merciful times I was actually able to get the upper hand on somebody by mistake on their part. Max from War Crime did. I think Tony told this story in here. He did basically get his eye popped out from a Boston beatdown type situation after being drunk and being like, fuck Straight Edge.
At the infamous Drop Dead Righteous Jam show.
Yes. Oh, wow. That was what a stack lineup.
I know. Like, whoever booked that, like, that's one of those ones that only plays in Cooch or Chris Corey's mind. In reality, it definitely was not the same show, I think.
That's a wild ass lineup. Actually, that was while I was sent away. I was not at that show, and I'm glad, because I probably would be missing both my eyes. I was such a little shit talker. But yeah. I'm Mr. No Beef now.
Yeah.
I'm a man of peace.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of it, is coming through. You know, I think the thing that draws people to be lead singers is the same thing that draws people into getting into ridiculous beefs with people. It's almost like that need for ultimately attention, I guess, but
yeah,
you know, like just sort of that need for interaction.
Did you ever have a major beef? I feel like you were kind of always a no beef guy in the national.
No, we had beefs in Toronto. We beefed with Terminal State. We beefed with Billy Talent, this big popular band. Like, all of these I regret, because I think all of them were miscommunications that really would have been like four words and it could have been sorted out without writing. But they were also very comical kind of beefs, I think. Like, you know, no physical violence at all.
Yeah, yeah. You guys always say, well, Canadian bands, I feel like, did not participate in as many beefs as, well, what was that fucking band? Omegas
from Montreal.
I feel absolutely. Like those guys could have beefs because they
had
big.
Some beefs. No Warning certainly had some beefs in their time.
No Warning. Yeah.
Chokehold definitely has had beefs on all sides of the political spectrum over the years. So
the thing is, like, when you're a young upcoming band, you want beefs.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's like, you know, cause like we're saying, like, you know, and that's the Tekashi 6ix9ine model, right? Like, that's the Oasis Blur model. Like, you're shown that, like, if you study music, if you're a fan of music, it says, okay, know how you get popular? Rivalries.
And honestly, it works because it boosts everybody, because most of the time if you're a musician, you don't have a lot to talk about.
No, exactly. Like, we're all overly privileged enough to be playing this music in a situation like we're in. So
I'm playing a pizza parlor in Altoona, Pennsylvania, on the desperate hope that Rick to Life shows up, which did not happen, by the way. He did not show up, even though apparently he goes to every other show at that venue. And so it's like, I need someone to be mad at us. And so we would always like talk about hipsters and like those bands we hated. And then like, now I'm like, that was ridiculous. Now if like I meet another adult who like I knew when I was in a punk scene, like, I mean, I'm still punk, but like I'm like thrilled to talk to them, because that means we have the shared like a million fucking things we can talk about.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing how we're like arguing with each other about music. And like realistically, on the spectrum of music, we're like basically on top of each other, no matter what you're into. If you're into ska punk or like Burning Spirits hardcore, in the musical spectrum, they're pretty much the same thing compared to like everything else that is out there. And yet,
yeah, we're both bad.
You don't like Burning Spirits hardcore?
No, dog.
What?
You want to get me started on, finish your point, and then I'm about to go
well,
off.
I don't know if my point's even worth making now, because it seems like this is going to be the end of things. This is going to be
no, I'm just joking.
I was just basically saying that, like, yeah, you beef with all these people, but at the end of the day, we're all fucking weirdos, and that's why we're in this thing to begin with, so let's just all be friends.
Yeah, that's how I view it now. I mean, I'm going to it like a, actually I don't even know who fucking is playing, but there's like a show at the Permanent Records spot in LA now. Remember that record store in Chicago?
Yeah, Permanent? Absolutely. Yeah.
They have like a venue. They only have one location now in LA, and it has like a, it's apparently like a sick venue. So
I've got great stuff in there too over the years.
Fucking good record store.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that fool, you remember Todd from LA? I can't remember. I feel like I was in Broken Needle, but
yeah, he was in Broken Needle. Todd from Broken Needle. Absolutely.
He's got a record store, Arroyo in Highland Park. It's pretty good too.
Damn, record stores. There's so many great record stores now too in LA.
Yeah. LA is sick now. It's weird.
Yeah. I guess it's like, it kind of comes in waves, right?
Yeah. I mean, New York's still cool. You know, they still got like Warthog and like those fucking bands out there.
Feels like it's going to be hard to get a new scene going because it's so expensive. I guess there's kids living there, but like, it just in terms of spaces to play and things like that, like it feels like LA's got, there's a lot more opportunity because it's so spread out.
For sure. And like, obviously, you know, they had those fucking Section Hate shows like outdoors and stuff.
Yeah.
And people in LA just like going to things. And so like the funny thing in San Francisco now is you got to play there on like a Wednesday, because it doesn't matter if you play on a Saturday, same people are showing up.
Yeah, that's true.
Burning Spirits. No. All right. I don't remember what year it is, but my like punk band, we got sort of put into the garage rock category. We're not garage rock. My punk band Wild Thing.
Yes.
Timmy Hefner generously let us switch shows from like the show we should have been playing with like shitty garage rock bands to the show that we wanted to play, which was with Poison Idea and like some, I think, Burning Spirits type bands. And people hated us so much that Logan Worrell had to smuggle me out of the venue because these skinheads like wanted to kick my ass because we were so, and like these like raw punks. But we replaced Bastard on the boat show.
Oh, wow.
The worst booking decision ever made in human history. Yeah. I have never seen people so disappointed to see a band as when we took the helm instead of Bastard. And I'm like, well, I'm sorry. Maybe they shouldn't do so much speed. They should have just been on Suboxone like me.
Well, that's the problem with the bands from Japan when they would come over for those fests. And then it's like all these drugs that cost tons and tons of money in Japan are like basically free in America.
Yes. Yeah. And people want to give them to, because people are like, oh, you're like Rob. I love Discharge. I like Disclose. And then the further down the step you go, and I understand Burning Spirits is different than that, but it's the same guys that like it.
Oh, well, yeah, though it's definitely like one of those things where you got to separate the North American fan from the music, because yeah, like I agree with you. Like the fans really make it hard to like the music sometimes.
Made me hate Ristetit for years. Because yeah. Ristetit was like the first band those kind of guys discovered in like 2007. Like when they like realized you could wear shoelaces, not just on your shoes, but around your head.
The shoelace. Like, yes.
Now everyone's shoelace, but you know what? I'm all love, you know,
man, I have never met anyone that disliked Burning Spirits before. Is it just did you like dislike it before Texas?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. I just never loved it. I just didn't. And you know, a fucking, you know, Randy Ransone.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was like the guy I was like boys with who like loved all that shit. Mm-hmm. And I'd like hang out with him and Scott. They'd always be playing this shit. And I'd be like, what's going on here? You know, but it's just stupid. Cause I refer to my podcast as the as the only Burning Spirits podcast, which is in the vain hopes that one of our listeners will get it and comment on that, which has never happened.
Well, but I wanted to bring that up to you because I heard that. And then I was also going to say, though, there's a Burning Spirits podcast about wrestling.
What?
That was called Burning Spirits. And guess what? One of the dudes from Dry Rot did it.
The Christian band?
Yeah.
Well, that was a band we had beef with because I was like, fuck these guys for being Christian and weird.
Yeah. No, I'm listening to the podcast. And you know where the Burning Spirits thing comes from? It's a wrestling reference.
No.
Yeah, because all those dudes and all those bands are obsessed with pro wrestling.
Yeah.
And it's a quote that Antonio Inoki said about Bruiser Brody, about being able to see the burning spirit in his eyes. And that's where they got the name from.
What?
Wow. It all comes back to wrestling, my friend. We're all just heels and faces.
It's true, dude. It's true. Who's the? I would say one of the biggest faces is probably Scotty. I'm trying to think of the biggest faces. Jonah's a face.
Jonah's a face. 100%. Jonah's a true face. Baby face.
Yeah.
Like, I guess if you go in old school, Ian MacKay, you know, would be a classic baby face. You know, it's great to when you see like one of these older punks do a heel turn later in life, where all
become
of a sudden,
evil.
Yeah, become evil, like start working. Like you did the reverse journey. Like you did a baby face turn.
Yeah, yes, yeah, yeah. I did a baby face turn because I didn't I felt it's tiring being evil, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also it feels like you're just rooting for the end of the world ultimately.
Yeah. Well, I didn't really think of I couldn't conceive of anything outside of myself and my immediate friend group and desires back then. Mm-hmm. I had a very funnily enough, considering I traveled so much for someone my age, you know, tour and stuff, I had a very provincial understanding of like the world and life. And like, I don't know what changed that, but that changed over time. I guess I grew older and I grew to love humanity instead of like despising it. You know who, Safira, I think is his name from Crucifix. He did a heel turn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of hardcore people do the heel turn.
But I just was like, you know what? There's more to life than just being the worst guy that you can be. I wasn't even the worst. Cause the thing is, I don't even have it in me to be an actual bad guy. It was like a character I played. And so like people would talk to me like after a show expected to be all like fucked up bad guy. And I would be like, hello. I mean, I wasn't like one of those guys who's like crazy on stage. And then it's like the biggest nerd afterwards, but I wasn't like, you know, you know what? I'm lying. I was so annoying off stage too, but well, I wasn't evil.
Well, I think the thing that was like always disarming about you was the fact that like you came off like an idiot on stage, but you're like really smart off stage. So I think that was also the thing that people were always taken aback by when they'd actually meet you.
Yeah. Yeah. That is something I realized that a lot of people, I kind of do the same thing on our podcast. I feel like too, is I play dumb sometimes. I mean, that's how it works with like my co-host is also really smart, but, you know, it's, and then, I don't know if I impress someone who's really smart if I meet them now, but like certainly in war crime days, I acted really stupid on stage.
Yeah.
And so people were like very confused talking to me afterwards.
Well, and like the fact that you could actually write, you know, like, I think that was also shocking when you actually did start writing and it wasn't offensive stuff, as you said, but like, it wasn't just offensive stuff. It was well-written.
It wasn't like Michael Board style.
Yeah. It was like Answer Me style.
Yeah. Yeah. God, Michael fucking Board, dude. All those MRR columnists.
I used to like, I remember like it was always the worst because you'd get there and there'd be like three columns that you wanted to read. And then the rest, you'd be like, fuck, how long is this person's column this month?
There were so many, I found out there were like legacy hires. Like Tim was like, you can't fire these people. And I'm like, what's he going to do? Haunt us? Like fire that motherfucker. Layla, fire him. He's a bad writer. You know, these like 90-year-old like curmudgeons being like punk sucks. Like you write for a magazine. Punk rules.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's why Bruce Roars was the best. Cause he loved punk the whole way through.
Bruce Roars was like a true mentor to me when I was younger. I mean, that was a guy who was always, he made you feel cool talking to him. There was a lot of guys like that when I was younger. I was like, wow, I can't believe this guy's like giving me the time of day. But Bruce Rose was like one of the main ones.
Yeah, and he never got jaded, it seems. Like there was always like a cool new band. Like he was the first guy in Max Rock and Roll to write about us.
Really?
Yeah, like he, well, we got reviewed as a demo, but then when the first 7-inch came out, he put us in the column. And I remember just being like, this is crazy. Like this felt like, that felt like a Lester Bangs review or something to me.
What was the first 7-inch?
No Pazuron with Circling the Drain.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's a good record.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah, that was the first time I heard about the Spanish Civil War through, because Mike was like a big like anarchist, right?
Yeah, Mike is still one of the most voracious readers ever, but he gave me recently his whole like zine collection and just going through the stuff he was on back then that I've like only caught up with now later in life, being like,
yeah,
wow, dude, like you were like a very well-read kid in his late teens.
Yeah. Well, how old were you guys when you started?
I guess we would have been 20. I would have been 21 and Mike would have been 20.
What? How old were you guys when you played in the Bay for the first time?
Oh, that would have been 24. I would have been 24.
Dude, I thought I was like, these guys are so old. And I guess you're like 10 years older than me. Or I mean, yeah. How old are you now?
42. I'm 10 years older than you.
No, you're 6 years old. Oh, no. You are 10 years older than me. I'm 32. I'm not 36.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to be like, because that's the thing I was shocked about, because I always thought you were older, but I guess I never thought War Crime were like that young.
Back then. Well, I was a lot younger than everyone else, even like at the time.
Yeah.
But I remember Bruce was like that. Jimmy from Annihilation Time was like that, where I was like, damn, this guy. Although Jimmy is the reason I am the way I am, because he was like my punk mentor and he is the biggest little shits. I was telling the story the other night. This motherfucker would go around a party as one time with a bucket of bleach. Everyone had their, you know, jeans or whatever. He would throw the bleach on people's jeans and yell, "Skinhead pants."
Well, that's Cleveland, right?
Like, yes.
That's that, you know, and especially in the Bay, that kind of like Cleveland level of aggressiveness, I imagine.
Shocked us. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so I mentioned the story in the podcast. I think it was Nine Shocks last show or some Urba band last show where they like barricaded the door and started pouring water mixed with gasoline on people and then lighting matches. Once I heard that, I was like, this is the level I got to be on. It's still, I'm going to do that someday. It's the most fucked up thing you can do to somebody.
I think it's at the last Gordon Solie motherfucker show where he does a blade job with like a Rambo knife and cuts his face off.
Jesus. Like, oh, like a real, like not beyond a blade job, just like scalps himself.
Well, he like tries to do like a blade job with this thing, but it's a Rambo knife. So this thing's not going to go just like just below the surface. It's going to go deep, dude.
Jesus Christ, man. Cleveland. There's a lot of Cleveland people that came to the Bay and that was always a big, I remember Urba used to send somebody that lived with Clint from Strung Up, I think Noel, videos, like video mixtape VHSs. And it was like the Mentors mixed with people getting hit by trains, mixed with women having sex with dogs to the tune of How Much Is That Doggy in the Window, to like 2 seconds of Screwdriver playing, to like Discharge full set. So like, it was like the most, and I'm watching this at like 15, like, and it was in the old Black Panther's house where that like 15, I can't remember his name, little Bobby Hutton got killed. And Dino from Dystopia lived in the fucking basement.
What?
And you could hear him have sex every time. No disrespect, Dino. He doesn't listen to podcasts. I heard Dino from Dystopia have sex probably throughout his entire relationship, because I'd stay over the house all the time and you'd always hear this basement.
That is, I remember going to Tony's house for the first time roadieing for Ruination maybe, and staying there and him busting out just the craziest tapes I'd ever seen. Like news anchors losing their minds on air and swearing, like the Bud Dwyer tape, like just like all this like shit that now I guess we all have access to because of YouTube and all these various other tube sites. But yeah, at the time felt like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah, dude. It was like, and I remember like seeing Target videos and it's like bootleg DVDs you'd buy at fucking, you know, like record swaps. But yeah. I've actually never met Tony Urba, but a hardcore hero of mine.
He
to
is
this day.
Same. Yeah, absolutely. Like, he's someone who I still kind of end the podcast by paraphrasing him all the time. Like, start a band, start a fanzine. Anyone can do this. Like, it just was like the most inspirational shit to hear this guy that I thought was like a rock and roll god, you know, tell me I could do it. You know,
I mean, that's the thing about punk, though, is if you're annoying enough, even if you can't fucking play, you can, like, punk is like the one thing that anyone can do and be good at.
Yeah.
Like, anything else, like rapping, fucking skateboarding, being a comedian, you have to have a modicum of talent. In punk, you don't actually need any talent at the actual thing.
Yeah.
You know, like, I can't sing.
But you need a lack of, which a lot of people don't have, you need that desperate yearning for attention that would mm-hmm. have you go up there and do that stuff.
Yes.
Like, I met this, like, very, you know, famous Canadian rock music singer, you know, and talking to him about being a lead singer and just like realizing that, oh, the same yearning that I have in my soul, the same void that I'm looking to fill by getting up there and humiliating myself is the same in this guy. And it's the same in all of us, right? Like, that's our talent, the lack of self-awareness.
Exactly. And it's like a low barrier of entry and lack of self-awareness is an incredible combo. Exactly. And like, people wonder why punk's still around. It's because of that, man. It's because it's like there's always a bunch of people who want people to look at them, but don't necessarily know, you know, they don't even know how to play an instrument or sing, but want that so bad that they're willing to do the most debased things to themselves to have that happen.
Well, Brace, I hope this hasn't been debasing for you because it's been amazing for me.
I've had a absolute joy.
Well, I want you got to come back. I want you and Tony to come on the show together one time.
Oh, so to Tony too. Check this fucking shit out. There is a guy who is like in another part of my life, unrelated to punk, also named Tony Molina, and everyone calls him Tony Molina.
What?
It's insane. Yes, it's in, who lived in the Bay, in this, not in the South Bay, actually. Well, a little bit in the South, like West Bay. I shouldn't say Tony will get mad at me, but it's West Bay. It's South Bay, but this other guy, Tony Molina, people would always be like, oh yeah, Tony Molina's coming to the party. And I'd be like, Tony Molina's coming? And it was always just this, the other Tony Molina is great, fantastic, sweetest man in the world. But I'm always disappointed.
He's not and the Tony Molina that you want.
Well, this guy lives in LA now. And so like a few months ago, my buddy was like, oh yeah, Tony Molina's coming around later. I'm like, Tony Molina's coming. Stop the presses. And it was the other Tony Molina.
Well, we got to get both Tony Molinas on here eventually and educate the fake Tony Molina about the real Tony
Molina summit. Yeah,
exactly. Well, dude, this has been awesome. And anytime you feel the hankering to come and talk about punk rock stuff, you know, the door is always open.
You guys are playing in down here soon too, right?
Fingers crossed. Yeah. Come out, man. We'll hang out.
Absolutely. Going to come out. Are you fucking crazy?
Do a workout cover. We're going to do a workout cover with you.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Thank you, Brace, for coming on the show. And you're right there. Brace will be back for a part two, hopefully with Tony Molina, both the real and the fake one, at some point in the near future. And once again, check out Brace's podcast, True and On, wherever you find your favorite podcasts. We're in the same store, so wherever you get this podcast, you can find their podcast. All right, that is it. Coming up later on this week on this podcast, a very kind of special thing that my buddy Danko Jones, one of the best front people ever, my friend, former guest of the show, I'm on his podcast a lot too. He and I have been working on this thing for throughout the pandemic. We've been doing this a little bit off and on where we do the show. It's called Roll the Dice with D&D. I think we're going to probably change the name because I don't think anyone likes that name. No, it's not a Dungeons and Dragons podcast. It's Danko and I going through our record collection, trying to find something weird and you know, teaching the other person about it. Anyway, we're going to be putting up the audio for the first episode. I'm going to be putting up the audio for the first episode on this podcast feed later on this week. And we will be dropping on Friday the first episode of Roll the Dice with D&D on YouTube. So go to youtube.com and look for Roll the Dice with D&D and you'll see it. You can hear it here, but you know, seeing is believing. But I just want to put up the audio too because this is a podcast. Anyway, that's it. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous peoples matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths, and just knock all this Nazi shit out. Because these aren't political issues. These are just basic human rights issues. So go get involved in organizations that are doing good work and try and bring about some change, positive change in the world. Speaking about bringing about positive change, you know, go out there and make your own culture. Start a band, start a fanzine, do something. That's kind of paraphrasing Tony Erba, but anyone can do this shit. Anyone can do this stuff. So go out there and make your own culture. It'll make you feel better. Speaking of feeling better, maybe try meditating. It might work. It might not. Who cares if it doesn't, you know, but if it does, that's kind of cool. I didn't think it was going to work for me, and it kind of does. So go figure. Sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. Get this shit on my body so they can embalm me and do or burn me or do whatever they're going to do with my body. Well, you're not going to be saying that because you're dead. And I think that's it. I'm bummed that I'm not on this tour. But I look forward to seeing people that will be at those shows in the future, in the future. And that is it. Thank you for listening. See you next episode. Bye.